is significant. We scooped up every single document. I think about 1,000 documents. We didn't leave anything behind. And going back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago in the broadcast, one of the memos that we discovered, a document said that agents should increase the paranoia among the left to have them believe that there's an FBI agent behind every mailbox. So they wanted to give this impression that everyone everywhere was under surveillance, and no one could believe that their constitutional rights would be protected.
And Bonnie, we only have about 30 seconds, but could you, the lessons for today for the Black Lives Matter movement and other activists of this COINTELPRO era?
Well, we've just come through a Trump era, and I think we saw the effects of a lack of transparency and accountability. And now we really have to insist that the powers that be are transparent and accountable. And it's up to the average citizen to pay attention, be informed, and be vigilant, and then call the powers that be to account for their decision.
We're going to have to leave it there, and I thank you so much for being with us. Bonnie Raines, one of the 1971 break-in burglars at the FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, and Paul Coates, founder and director of Black Classic Press. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
This is Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, and you're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
Hello, my friends. This is Life During Wartime.
Tune in to KBOO on Wednesday, March 17th at 10 p.m. for Life During Wartime.
Not just a regular Life During Wartime, playing punk and hardcore, having live bands, and letting you know all the underground DIY punk happenings going on in the Portland metro area.
Just because we're different, they have a spaz attack.
This is a celebration marathon. It's from 10 p.m. to 5:30 a.m. It's our 26th year on the air. So we're having a 25th anniversary celebration.
Looking back at the DJs and bands
Life During Wartime
that have made Life During Wartime a punk institution in Portland, at KBOO, and on the World Wide Web.
Celebrate 25 years of Life During Wartime by donating during our anniversary marathon celebration.
On Wednesday, March 17th, from 10 p.m. to 5:30 a.m.
Here on your community radio station.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO is hiring a membership director. Our membership director maintains relationships with KBOO members and listeners, create a process to meet or exceed fundraising goals, and manage the membership database. For a complete job description and instructions on how to apply, visit kboo.fm/employment. Apply by March 15th. KBOO is an affirmative action and equal opportunity employer.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News. Researchers at OHSU have discovered the first U.S. case of a new COVID-19 variant in Oregon. Oregon City is holding a mayoral election today after the former mayor was recalled. And the security fence surrounding the federal courthouse in downtown Portland is being removed. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 9th, 2021. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. The Oregon Health Authority reported 517 new cases of COVID-19 on Tuesday. Health officials have not reported more than 500 cases in a single day since February 25th. In total, Oregon has had 158,000 cases of COVID-19. Health officials also reported 5 new deaths on Tuesday, raising the state's death toll to 2,303 people. There are currently 134 people hospitalized with COVID-19 statewide, including 31 patients in intensive care units. Governor Kate Brown announced on Tuesday that Multnomah County, Oregon's most populous, will move from high COVID risk to moderate risk this Friday, March 12th. Multnomah County will join Washington and Clackamas counties at the moderate level, allowing more people at indoor businesses such as restaurants and gyms. Only 2 Oregon counties remain in the state's extreme risk level, Coos and Douglas County. As of Tuesday, more than 1.1 million first and second doses of a COVID-19 vaccine have been administered across Oregon. Researchers at Oregon Health and Science University said Tuesday that they have discovered the first known case of the E484K mutation of COVID-19 in the U.S. in Oregon. The E484K mutation, also known as the EEK mutation, has been found in Brazil, South Africa, and the United Kingdom. Oregon's case is a first for the U.S., and researchers believe it occurred spontaneously, a sign that the virus is evolving. Scientists that are tracking how the COVID-19 virus is changing in Oregon say there is evidence that other variants of the virus are spreading locally. Dr. Brian O'Rourke, an associate professor of molecular and medical genetics at OHSU, said, quote, "The virus is changing and trying to evolve as we're trying to fight the virus. We knew it was just a matter of time before the variants entered the U.S. and started to spread in our communities." O'Rourke stressed that even against these variants, current research suggests the COVID-19 vaccine is still effective in preventing severe cases of disease and death. O'Rourke added that the most important takeaway from the recent mutation discoveries is the importance of staying the course and following COVID-19 safety protocols, including wearing masks in public. Nationally, the U.S. has reported at least 29.1 million cases of COVID-19 and more than 526,000 deaths. Over the past week, there has been an average of about 59,000 new cases per day, a decrease of 12% from the average 2 weeks earlier. As of Tuesday, about 18% of the U.S. population has received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, with about 10% fully vaccinated. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 117.4 million people in nearly every country. At least 2.6 million people have died across the world. The long-awaited trial of former Minneapolis, Minnesota police officer Derek Chauvin began jury selection Tuesday after being delayed by a day. Chauvin is on trial for the murder of George Floyd in May of 2020. For the latest on the story, we go to Samantha Hong Long with Racial Reckoning, The Arc of Justice.
All eyes are on Minneapolis as the murder trial of Derek Chauvin gets underway. On Monday, hundreds of protesters filled the streets outside of the Hennepin County Courthouse.
Say his name! Say his name!
Meanwhile, inside the courthouse, attorneys debated whether or not Judge Cahill has jurisdiction to begin the trial. On Friday, the Court of Appeals ordered the judge to reconsider adding a third-degree murder charge, but the ruling has not been finalized. Prosecutor Matthew Frank asked to delay jury selection until a decision has been made about that ruling.
While this appeal is pending, the court doesn't have authority to hear matters that are involved in the trial.
Frank said he's wary of selecting jurors when he doesn't yet know what the charges are. Both sides agreed to strike 16 potential jurors based on the biases revealed in their pre-trial questionnaires. Judge Cahill also agreed to the questioning of 14 potential jurors in the court Tuesday.
As I've said to the state, unless the Court of Appeals tells me otherwise, we're going to keep moving.
Judge Cahill said witness lists must be confirmed by March 22nd, with testimonies currently set to begin March 29th. As many as 400 witnesses could be called. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Samantha Honglong.
Racial Reckoning, the Arc of Justice, is produced and supported by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, in partnership with KMLJ Radio and the Minnesota Humanities Center. Online at racialreckoningmn.org.
The fence around the federal courthouse in downtown Portland is finally being removed. KBOO's Al Kahn has more.
The security fence around the Marco Hatfield Federal Courthouse in downtown Portland, which was installed by the federal government, is coming down this week after being in place for 8 months at a cost of over $200,000. The fence was built by the Federal Protective Service in response to racial justice and police violence protests last summer, which lasted for over 100 consecutive nights, during which unmarked federal agents were deployed to the city. A spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security has said there has been an ongoing discussion on both local and federal levels, involving Mayor Ted Wheeler's office, the Portland Police Bureau, and the Portland Bureau of Transportation on exactly when to remove the fence, and now have decided that the time is right. Both the Portland Bureau of Transportation and the Bureau of Environmental Services have levied fines against the federal government pertaining to the fence, which have added up to several million dollars, a fine which the government has no intention of paying. For KBOO News, I'm Al Khan.
Oregon City residents are voting Tuesday to elect a new mayor after former Mayor Dan Holliday was recalled. Last spring, Holliday considered issuing a declaration to reopen businesses after the state shut down due to the COVID-19 pandemic. After the state attorney threatened criminal action, Holliday relented. Then, in June of 2020, during ongoing protests calling out racial injustice, the former mayor referred to police brutality against Black people as, quote, hardly an epidemic, end quote. Despite calls for his resignation, Holliday refused to step down. After a committee mounted a months-long campaign to recall him, Oregon City residents voted 68% in favor of ousting the mayor. Oregon City voters now have the chance to elect a mayor from a diverse group of candidates, including current Oregon City Commissioner Rachel Lyle Smith, former Oregon City Commissioner Damon Mabee, former Secretary of the Democratic Party of Oregon Alex Josephy, and small business owner Leslie Wright Jr. The winner will serve the remainder of Holliday's term through 2022. Voters have until 8 p.m. to return their ballot to either the Clackamas County Elections Office or the Oregon City City Hall. National Guard troops are expected to remain in Washington, D.C. as security threats continue. For more, we go to KBOO's Al Khan.
As the March 12th deadline approaches for National Guard troops to leave the Washington, D.C. area, Pentagon is expected to extend the deployment to the Capitol as continued security threats keep coming. As details are being worked out, final approval is expected to be given by Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and continue to provide security in Washington at the request of the Capitol Police. The extension, however, has received some resistance from state governors, who refuse to have their guard remain in the city any longer. But Defense Department officials have said that enough states have agreed to supply troops to complete the mission. The troops currently deployed in Washington will be relieved by the incoming guard members, though they may need to stay for a day or two as the new troops are properly briefed and settled in. The main security concern remains threats from the far-right groups, such as Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, and QAnon conspiracy theorists, who continue to threaten Capitol buildings and Congress members. Chief of the National Guard Bureau, General Daniel Hawkinson, has been visiting the deployed troops several times a week to ensure their welfare. For KBOO News, I'm Al Khan.
Transgender advocate groups are opposing new bills in many state legislatures that would ban transgender athletes from playing on school sports teams. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem said on Monday that she will sign a bill passed by the legislature to bar transgender girls and women from participating in female sports leagues. However, whether it ultimately takes permanent effect in the state will likely be decided in federal court. According to South Dakota's High School Athletics Association, which opposes the bill, no transgender girl currently plays in a female high school sports league in the state. The Human Rights Campaign criticized Noem for endorsing the bill, saying, quote, "Trans girls and their families are your constituents. You are using your power to exclude kids and make them feel less than, and that is nothing to be proud of." Only one state, Idaho, has enacted a law limiting trans students' sports participation, and that measure has been blocked by a court ruling. However, this has not stopped other states, such as Maine, from considering legislation. Lily Bulkey has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Advocates for transgender Mainers are opposing a newly introduced bill in the state legislature that would ban trans students from participating in girls' or women's school sports. Maine is one of more than 20 states where similar legislation has been introduced. And Quinn Gormley with the Maine Transgender Network says this bill is part of a national campaign to target trans people, especially trans young people.
It's really a disingenuous effort on the part of people who would like to see trans people unable to participate in school and in society at large.
The bill would require students who want to challenge a school's questioning of their gender to undergo a privacy-invading medical exam. Gormley says while the network is confident it won't pass in the legislature, even debating bills like this can be harmful to trans kids. While proponents say they're trying to protect female athletes from unfair competition, in nearly all of the states pursuing similar bills, sponsors have been unable to point to a single local instance in which trans participation has been an issue. Gormley points to research that shows, in fact, when trans kids are encouraged to participate in sports, all students benefit.
And so we know that trans inclusion is not only good for making school life and student life safer for trans girls, but more encouraging of growth and leadership development and teamwork for all girls, which is, of course, the benefits anyone gets from playing on a sports team in school.
Gormley says it's key to understand that this bill did not come up organically in Maine. Rather, it came from conservative national groups drafting model legislation for states to take up in accordance with their own political motivations. For Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Maria Cahill from Pacific Northwest Family Circle discussing state-level legislation on changing police culture and accountability. Then at 6, it's Preference, and at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 38 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a high of 55 degrees. Today in history, in 1997, rapper and songwriter The Notorious B.I.G. is fatally shot at a stoplight in Los Angeles, California. The murder was thought to be the culmination of an ongoing feud between rap artists from the East and West Coasts. Biggie's death came just weeks before his new album, titled Life After Death, was scheduled to be released. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2020. The quote of the day is from the Notorious B.I.G. song, Sky's the Limit. Biggie said, quote, "Stay far from timid, only make moves when your heart's in it, and live the phrase, sky's the limit." The House votes on the American Rescue Plan. President Joe Biden signs orders to advance gender equity, and, with legislation pending to protect voting rights, pressure grows to end the Senate filibuster. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
This could mark a real turning point in our fight against COVID-19.
Vice President Kamala Harris touted the American Rescue Plan and also announced a $250 million program to improve literacy about coronavirus vaccines and other issues in underserved communities. The COVID relief bill is expected to be passed by the House today, despite Senate changes to tighten stimulus check income limits and reduce unemployment benefits. Democratic Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal of Washington calls it a huge win for progressives.
It was bad policy and bad politics to weaken any of the things that we passed in the House, but ultimately those were relatively minor concessions in terms of the entire package.
The bill is expected to be signed before March 14th when unemployment benefits expire. As the world marked International Women's Day Monday, President Joe Biden signed two executive orders to advance gender equity. The first creates the White House Gender Policy Council, co-chaired by Chief of Staff to the First Lady, Julissa Reynoso.
We're really looking at long-term structural changes that can advance the full integration of women, women of color, women all over, so that issues of discrimination and equity and equality in the labor force and in pay can be addressed in a systemic manner long-term.
The second calls for a review of Trump administration changes to the law prohibiting sex-based discrimination in education, Title IX. Also Monday, First Lady Dr. Jill Biden honored 21 women with the State Department's International Women of Courage Award.
These women made an extraordinary choice to persist, to demand justice, to believe that despite the obstacles and fear that they faced, that there is a future worth fighting for.
In election news, the Georgia Senate passed a bill which would repeal no-excuse absentee voting. Opponents contend it restricts voting freedom. Supporters argue it improves voting integrity. The Supreme Court rejected former President Trump's last pending 2020 election lawsuit, which alleged Wisconsin election officials violated the Constitution by expanding absentee voting during the pandemic. Missouri Republican Senator Roy Blunt will not seek re-election in 2022, the fifth GOP senator to announce plans before the midterms. The Senate will soon take up voting rights with the For the People Act. Concerns about a Republican filibuster have elevated debate about the procedure's future. Supporters say it ensures compromise with the minority party. Constitutional law professor Caroline Fredrickson disagrees.
The idea of bipartisanship that happens in the Senate because of the filibuster is myth-making that needs to be put to rest.
She contends the filibuster can repress democracy and argues there would be more bipartisan support if just 50 votes were needed.
Then there would be a play for all those votes in the middle. You needed 51 or 52, you'd actually be fighting for them. When you need 60, there's almost no point in actually engaging in negotiation.
The White House said Monday President Biden does not support changing filibuster rules. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
The latest COVID-19 relief package contains a large investment in Indian country, and a panel raises awareness about missing and murdered Native people in California. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The latest COVID-19 relief package contains the largest one-time investment the federal government has ever made in Indian country. The Mountain West News Bureau's Savannah Marr reports.
The package includes $20 billion in direct aid to tribal governments and another $11 billion for federal Indian programs. And it comes as many tribal nations are struggling to stay afloat. That includes the Mescalero Apache tribe in southern New Mexico, where despite a dip in new COVID-19 cases, the economic situation is still dire. President Gabe Aguilar says many tribal citizens are out of work, including hundreds laid off from jobs at the tribe's casinos. He says at one point during the pandemic, they had only 29 people working.
Now I'd say we're about half, maybe 600. We're still not out of the water yet.
He says much of the aid money will help those tribal citizens with basic needs like food, housing, and utilities. It will also pay for social services, typically covered by gaming revenues.
I think this is just going to help us where come next year, we'll be okay.
The package also includes big investments in the Indian Health Service, federal Indian housing programs, and critical infrastructure projects on tribal land. For National Native News, I'm Savannah Marr.
A recent panel raised awareness about missing and murdered Indigenous people in California. Advocates, family members, law enforcement, and researchers discussed bringing the issue to the forefront of policymakers and the public. Assemblymember James Ramos talked about his bill AB 3099 to improve data collection and increase collaboration with law enforcement on missing Native Americans in California. Ramos says advocacy and education are a key part of the work, keeping it in the ears of the governor and legislature.
This is nothing new to Indian country, the crisis of missing and murdered Native American women. But yet, exposing those that are non-Native people to what's going on, and that's what this bill starts to do. So the advocacy is important to make sure that all those in the state of California and the United States understand that this is a true issue happening in Indian country.
The bill was signed by the governor last year and became law in January. It requires funding by the legislature for the Justice Department to determine how to increase state criminal justice protective and investigative resources for reporting and identifying missing Native Americans. The bill requires a report to be presented to the legislature upon completion of the study. Ramos is the first and only California Native American serving in the state legislature. Since elected in 2018, he's advanced a number of Native American issues. The Arctic Winter Games International Committee will postpone the 2022 Games in Canada. KNBA's Trip Krause has more.
According to a news release, the Arctic Winter Games International Committee, the host society, Wood Buffalo Municipality, and the government of Alberta made the decision out of concern for the COVID-19 pandemic. In a news release, International Committee President John Flynn says, quote, "The health and safety of our circumpolar participants, coaches, and volunteers is of paramount concern. And although it is a great disappointment that we must postpone the 2022 Arctic Winter Games, we are steadfast in our decision," end quote. New dates for the 2022 Games have not been set. The Arctic Winter Games are scheduled every 2 years. The multi-sport event, an Indigenous cultural celebration, incorporates communities and participants from around the circumpolar north. the 2020 games in Whitehorse were canceled because of coronavirus. The release did not state how a potential rescheduling of the 2022 games would affect the 2024 games, which are scheduled to be in Alaska. For National Native News, I'm Trip Krause.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Climate change could drive Komodo dragons to extinction, as they could lose much of their habitat during the next 30 years. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Huge lizards called Komodo dragons have lived for hundreds of thousands of years on a handful of islands in Indonesia. It's their only home. But over the past century, habitat loss and hunting have threatened the iconic species. And now, climate change could drive it to extinction. Alice Jones of the University of Adelaide in Australia says rising seas will likely flood many areas where the dragons live.
They seem to be in these sort of low-lying valleys which are separated by tall mountains, and they don't really like to live on the steep slopes.
The cold-blooded animals also need access to cool, shaded spots to help regulate their body temperature. But as the region gets hotter and forest cover is lost,
some of those types of habitats that are important for the lizards to be able to cool off in, those are probably going to disappear or reduce in their area.
Jones was part of a team that modeled how Komodo dragons will fare under a range of scenarios. They found that unless climate pollution is sharply reduced, the animals will likely lose over half of their habitat within the next 30 years. So she says it's critical to protect the limited area that remains to help this ancient species survive the modern era. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. A few screening methods can reduce people's risk of the disease becoming life-threatening. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
March is Awareness Month for a very deadly disease, colorectal cancer. But the good news is that there are screening tools that increase a person's chances of survival. The most important tool is the colonoscopy, where doctors can identify potentially cancerous polyps. Jerrica Carver with the Lincoln Community Health Center in Newport says there's another important screening method called the FIT test, which is unique because people can do it at home.
So in the times of COVID, that's really important because we've seen a decrease in providers seeing patients in office and actually putting a hold on screening for colonoscopies during the first part of COVID last year.
The FIT test looks for microscopic blood in the stool and has to be done annually. Carver says Lincoln Community Health Center started sending out FIT tests for patients who didn't come in for screenings last year. Their screening rate increased from 45% last year to 62% this year. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death for men and women combined. Carver says screening makes a difference.
Colorectal cancer is one of the cancers that's unique in the fact that you can actually prevent the cancer by screening. So it's estimated that about 50% of the colorectal cancer-related deaths could have been prevented by screening.
Carver says people also can lower their risk of colorectal cancer by exercising often and not consuming too much alcohol or red meats. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 9th, 2021. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Al Kahn, the producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Lily Bulkey, Samantha Hong Long, Mary Sherman, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. News and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon brings residents the information they need to fully engage with issues in their community. At 9:30, it's Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw, covering art, culture, and politics with hip-hop as the guiding light. At 10, it's the Children's Hour with guest DJ Twinkle, an award-winning bilingual children's musician and TV star who will be featuring music from around the world. Then at 11, it's the Dirt Bag. Host Glenn Anderson is joined by Jim Gilbert to talk about the February weather and what it did and didn't do to our gardens. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We're speaking with Maria Cahill from Pacific Northwest Family Circle about legislation in Oregon to change police culture and accountability.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You have a legal system that is fraught with politics and preference for certain groups, then they expect us to use that same legal system to press enforcement.
With me today is Maria Cahill, a volunteer from the Pacific Northwest Family Center, a community group supporting Washington and Oregon families affected by police violence. The group will meet with Oregon Representative Janelle Bynum for a town hall on Thursday to discuss several policing bills being considered at the State House. Thanks for joining me, Maria.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ethan.
The Pacific Northwest Family Center has been on KBOO a couple of times. Could you quickly reiterate what it is that your community group does?
Yeah, so we unite families who've lost loved ones to police violence. We're a multiracial organization and invite family members of any relationship to someone who's been killed by police to struggle for justice with us. Our mission is to change laws and policies and ultimately to change the culture of policing in Oregon and Washington. Basically, anyone can join if they live in Oregon and Washington and have had a family member killed somewhere else, or if a family member has been killed in Oregon and Washington.
And there's a couple of bills going through the State House right now that your group is interested in. Could you explain what's in those bills?
Well, now, I would love to, and this is why everyone should come to the town hall and find out what's actually in the bills, because what happens with legislation, if folks don't know, is that one single word in a piece of legislation can change the way it's interpreted, from holding police accountable to letting them, again, just continue to do whatever they want to do. We have a number of bills that we've prioritized this legislative session. House Bill 2309 requires peace officers performing official duties in uniform to display certain information on the uniform. You know, identifying police officers is important to Pacific Northwest Family Circle family members because the officers in last year's protests were intentionally covering up their identifications with like cell phones and other pieces of equipment so that they wouldn't be held accountable for excessive force and likely misconduct. We're very interested to see that peace officers performing official duties need to have certain information on their uniform, and we have very specific guidance. We feel like this is a good start, but there's a lot more that needs to be done to be able to identify an officer from, let's say, 25 feet away. The community should be able to identify a police officer. If we want to support police officers and know what they're doing and hold them accountable, this is one way to do it. House Bill 2481 prohibits law enforcement agencies from receiving certain military surplus equipment from the federal government. There are two family members in Pacific Northwest Family Circle whose loved ones were killed by police from an armored vehicle. 54-year-old loved one Remy Sabby was on his own property during a mental health crisis when Washington County sheriffs showed up in basically a tank. We're not supposed to call it a tank, but it's basically a tank, an armored vehicle, and was killed from the safety of that armored vehicle. Loved one, Captain Brian A. Babb, was in Eugene. He was a veteran and having a PTSD crisis. He was in the middle of a conversation with his VA counselor, and she called for a wellness check on him, and police officers came and killed him in an armored vehicle. So we are very interested to get rid of military surplus equipment in Oregon. This law does not do that, but it does start to limit what's called the 1033 federal program, which actually gives surplus military equipment free to various agencies, or there's another grant program that they can buy it at low cost. House Bill 2513 requires police officers to be trained in airway and circulatory anatomy and physiology and certified in cardiopulmonary resuscitation. You know, I kind of balked at this bill because I thought, really, you don't know that you're going to kill somebody by kneeling on their neck for 9 minutes? But a family member, April Sabby, wife of 54-year-old loved one Remy Sabby, said that after he was shot, police officers inappropriately tried to resuscitate him, and this caused him to bleed out faster. So with this training, police officers can no longer say they didn't know that that was going to happen. House Bill 2936 requires Department of Public Safety standards and training to investigate person's character before accepting person for training and certification as police officer or reserve officer. So this is something that Pacific Northwest Family Circle family members have been calling for through our monthly Feet to Fire protests that have been going on for the last at least three years, I guess maybe 4 years now. Since 2016, we've been outside the Multnomah County Courthouse and Clackamas County Courthouse, and we even went to Eugene, to Lane County Courthouse once to call for police reform through the district attorney's office. And one of the things that we've been demanding through this national Feet to Fire protest, where other organizations are also going to their courthouses once a month around the country, these are part of our national demands to do a much better job at screening people. And so, again, this bill is a good start, but there are other things that we would want to see in this bill. House Bill 2933 provides that it is unlawful for government authority or agent to engage in pattern or practice that deprives persons of rights, privileges, or immunities. There are some problems with this, right? One arm of the government employs the police, and one arm of the government then investigates the police. I mean, ideally. Right now, the police just investigate the police. They investigate themselves. Like whenever a loved one has been killed, maybe that's changing now, but for all the members of Pacific Northwest Family Circle so far, police have pretty much investigated themselves. The next best thing is for some other branch of government to investigate the police. Now, we've seen how fraught that is with politics at the Department of Justice in Oregon, where the City of Portland's settlement agreement has not been adequately enforced because that division was intentionally gutted by Billy J. Williams, our U.S. attorney, our outgoing U.S. attorney. The best thing after that would be to have community investigate police and decide on disciplinary action, but that's a Senate bill that we're not going to be looking at on Thursday. House Bill 2934 is the last one, and it provides that public safety officers who represent that person is acting as employee or agent of public body, is acting in scope of employment for purposes of Oregon Tort Claims Act. There's other parts of that description. But I can tell you that this is really all about bringing civil suit against a police officer. And there are a lot of challenges with family members finding lawyers to represent them, even when they want to bring a legal case against the officers. This law would remove one of those barriers, which is that lawyers don't make enough money to take a case in Oregon. So this raises the limit to something that is more amenable to lawyers actually supporting families in their justice struggle. Those are the six that we're most interested in.
So you mentioned at the beginning that in addition to changing the laws of policing, the Pacific Northwest Family Center is also looking at changing the culture surrounding policing. I was hoping you could speak a little bit more to what that looks like.
Oh, my heart is just so warmed by this question. I really appreciate it. We operate as a public grieving organization. We try to work with the same transparency and accountability that we expect from police officers, and we try to work with the same kind of respect that we would like from police officers. For instance, all the Feet to Fire protests look different depending on what chapter is out there protesting in their own state nationally. Our protest is definitely filled with protest signs, and it's also we set up a PA system, and we talk to the public for 2 hours about what families experience when they struggle for justice for their loved ones, what kind of harassment from police. Families get constant harassment. This is one of the reasons that families take settlements. It's one of the reasons why they will stay silent, is because they themselves are criminalized. The federal government doesn't even recognize them as victims. So we try to get information like that out into the public. Our official motto is peace, not police. Our unofficial motto is we break hearts. We're not necessarily yelling, we're lecturing, really. And I might be there speaking on behalf of family members that aren't there or on behalf of the organization. Other family members are certainly there speaking their truth, like Donna Hayes, talking about her grandson, Moose Hayes, known only in death as Quanis Hayes. We have red heart balloons for every single one of the loved ones with the names of them on there, hanging there. And there are people chalking the names of loved ones killed in Oregon and elsewhere, all up and down the sidewalk. So there's every month we do this protest, there's a temporary memorial for the loved ones. A lot of family members are not anti-police, even though police have killed their loved ones. We work to really try to keep police safe as well.
Have the police been open to dialogue?
We have not invited that dialogue, honestly, as an organization. Family members have gone to a variety of police chats. We have not invited it, nor has anyone reached out to us. But at our protests, Irene Kalonji's son, Christopher Kalonji, was murdered. He's 19 years old. He was murdered in his bedroom during a mental health crisis and was allowed to bleed out for 4.5 hours while they tear gassed his home and did $15,000 worth of damage. The Kalonji family, after the murder of their son, became houseless for 2 years. And I say all of this not only to get the story of Christopher Kalonji out there, which is one of the ways that we change all of the culture, but I also say this to let people know the extremity of what Irene and Tony have gone through. And yet, police officers will come up to her in front of the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office and talk to her, and she is completely respectful. You know, she engages with them. So we engage with individuals when we can. We've had a conversation with Chuck Lavelle about two officers who harassed a family member for 7 years. They killed her son and then went to the McDonald's where she worked for 7 years, almost every day, and harassed her. And we went to Chuck Lavelle, who is now police chief, and said, this is happening and it needs to stop. And he investigated it and agreed, issued some paperwork to say that they weren't allowed to go to the McDonald's again, and they continued to go there. And nothing was ever done. You know, obviously, like, almost nothing is almost ever done. She had to quit her job to get away from those officers. So we don't have a lot of faith in those conversations necessarily, but we're open to them. I think the way we really change the culture of policing is by changing the understanding of the public so that they demand better. And we do that through storytelling.
In that particular case where you went to Chuck Lavelle and then he issued an order to those officers who were doing the harassment, even though there was an order in place, it wasn't particularly effective. Why might these laws and issuances from police administration not actually be enforced? And why might they not be changing police behavior?
I ask myself that every day, and that is a question that we're going to ask Janelle Bynum. How are these laws different? I look at these laws, I look at the language, there's no enforcement. So you have a legal system that is fraught with politics and preference for certain groups, then they expect us to use that same legal system to press enforcement. You know, there's databases out there that are already requiring agencies to submit when they have excessive uses of force. Portland Cop Watch has been tracking this for the state for many years. They're not reporting all the cases. Portland Cop Watch finds many more deaths than are reported to the Department of Justice, and no one does anything. I don't have an answer for that, but I hope Janelle Bynum does.
Would you consider Janelle Bynum an ally in the State House? And would you say that you have other allies and sympathizers in the State House who are really going to lend their support to these bills?
I really can't answer that as an organizational spokesperson. We have not discussed much the concept of who we consider allies. And I think ally is a really important term that someone else gives you. And I have not heard any of Pacific Northwest Family Circle family members call any legislators an ally. That may be because of my own personal comments about how legislators are really motivated by other issues than what's really important to the family members whose loved ones were killed by police. I think for us, the only people we would really call allies are other people who've lost loved ones to police violence. And I will, for transparency, say that I am not one of those people and that I do not have any power in the organization. It's only family members who make decisions about how things happen. But I would say that there are a number of legislators who can be helpful. And I think Representative Bynum and Senator Manning and Senator Pruzanski are some of the folks that have been helpful in this session.
You started the Feet to the Fire campaign 3 years ago. And in that time, the conversation around police violence in the United States has changed quite a bit. Just today, Derek Chauvin, the murderer of George Floyd, is going on trial for third-degree murder. Are there steps being made in the right direction right now, or is this sort of a one step forward, two steps back kind of a battle at the moment?
That's an excellent question. I really think we're moving forward. And I don't necessarily think we're moving forward as much in the legal realm. I think police are still inappropriately controlling a lot of the language around legislation. I know a lot of family members would like to see police officers not have so much influence over the language. But I do think that seeing people like Senator Pruzanski waking up and recognizing that we don't have accountable police.
From KBOO News, I'm Ethan Sandweiss.
That was a conversation with Maria Cahill from Pacific Northwest Family Circle. The group is hosting a virtual town hall with State Representative Janelle Bynum on Thursday, March 11th at 5 p.m. to discuss several policing bills being considered at the State House. Up next is Noise Filter, where the latest coronavirus public health updates are broken down by infectious disease and community health experts. Stay with us.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
right. Welcome to Noise Filter. This is Dr. Mark Calendari. Doc Griggs is not able to be with us today. So this is one of my favorite segments in which I get to review some of the interesting public health research that has come out in the past week. So let's go ahead and get started. Okay, so let's look at mental health and pandemics. So could post-pandemic PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, be a major mental health concern? Well, in this study, which was a meta-analysis of 88 studies, so a meta-analysis is basically a study of studies. So in this meta-analysis, they took 88 studies of people who develop PTSD after several different infectious diseases pandemics that happened just in the 21st century. What you're saying in the 21st century? Well, listen to this list. They talked about SARS, H1N1, which was the swine flu, poliomyelitis, Ebola, Zika, Nipah, MERS, H5N1, right? That was the avian flu, and then, of course, COVID-19. So they took all of the studies that looked at PTSD after pandemics, and they basically looked for commonalities there. Now, of course, one of the major problems with meta-analyses is that each study is done just a little bit differently. So the results can be somewhat concerning, and there are some people in the medical field who really don't like meta-analysis, and of course I understand that, but what they really do help us do is understand a bit about a phenomenon that's on a large basis that's just almost impossible to study. So these do give us some indications of some things. So what they found was that the overall pooled prevalence of post-pandemic post-traumatic stress disorder across all populations was about 1 in 5 people. So 1 in 5 people after a pandemic will experience PTSD. When they looked at healthcare workers, that went up to 30%. And after 6 months, it went down, fortunately, to 10%. The prevalence of PTSD in the general public was 19%, and after 6 months, it also went down to 12%. But listen to this. The PTSD in COVID-positive people was 19%, and after 6 months, it actually went up to 29%. So moving forward, what we do have to recognize is that public health strategies involving mental health responses are definitively warranted. So we'll continue to follow up on this study. So this next set of studies are all going to be kind of clustered into one. We're essentially going to be talking about some of these new viral variants. And these viral variants are important because what we are finding that these various variants do weaken or deneutralize antibodies. So this was a particular study that looked at the variant that emerged out of South Africa. It's called the B1351. Or it's also called the 501Y.V2. We'll just refer to it as the B1351 variant. And what essentially it showed when they took the serum of 6 people who recovered from natural COVID-19, so they had natural immunity, they found that the variant that emerged out of South Africa significantly weakened antibody response from 6 to 200 times. What this indicates is that reinfection with these new viral variants is very likely going to be a thing that we will see moving forward. So natural immunity does not protect somebody. So what's natural immunity? Natural immunity means you got COVID-19, you have antibodies rather for COVID-19 that were acquired not from vaccine, but from natural infection. In other words, you got infected because your child or your spouse had it, or you just had it. So immunity that was acquired from just regular old infection, those individuals very likely can be reinfected with these new variants, and we'll continue to follow that. So
So one of the things that I talk a lot about is COVID-19 and vitamins. And one of the things that I often say is that in the U.S., we have the most expensive wastewater because we have mostly an unregulated vitamin industry that basically can make whatever comments they want to make, and people tend to buy them. And because people want to do something good for their health, they tend to buy into some of those false claims. And when I tell people, no, I don't take any vitamins regularly, no, they don't have to take any vitamins. And as an infectious diseases doctor who deals with people living with HIV, I regularly tell my HIV positive patients they do not need to take regular vitamins, especially if they have a balanced and healthy diet. So what this study did was look at particularly vitamin C and zinc to determine whether or not they would lessen COVID symptoms. And so this was a very nice randomized controlled trial that was intended to answer the question, does vitamin C and zinc help decrease symptoms associated with COVID-19? They looked at an outpatient population, and what they found was the answer was no. And the study was stopped early because the results were so disappointing, and there was no way that the vitamin C arm or the arm with zinc and vitamin C was going to outpace the standard of care. And so in the end, what they ultimately found out was that zinc and vitamin C are not helpful for COVID symptoms. So if you're one of these folks that advise your friends, or maybe you yourself thought that these sorts of things you would do well with, the answer is no, that scientific studies do not show that the use of vitamin C and zinc are helpful. Now, we have talked a lot here on COVID Noise Filter about the effects of vitamin D. Now, there may be a thing for people who are vitamin D deficient, but that's something that you would know from your primary health care provider. So this next study here was another randomized controlled trial. So these are the best type of studies. This was double blind. This was over multiple sites. They looked at hundreds of patients to see whether or not when they got to the hospital, did one dose of vitamin D help them decrease the hospital length of stay? And they looked at a couple other parameters as well. So essentially, these were hospitalized patients that were moderately to severely ill. They got one dose of vitamin D when they walked in the door. The treatment group in the placebo arm or the control arm got placebo. Okay, so what did they find? So they essentially found that there was no difference in the length of stay between the treatment and control arm. So that is those that got one dose of vitamin D versus those that didn't. And there was no difference in secondary outcomes. What they did see was that those that got vitamin D did see an increase in their concentration of vitamin D. Now, they did not look specifically at people who were vitamin D deficient or vitamin D sufficient. The other thing, too, is that they were looking at moderately to severely ill individuals that were in the hospital. They did not look at anybody as an outpatient. But in the end, what they found that there was no benefit to the administration of vitamin D for inpatient moderately to severely ill patients. One group that was not studied was COVID-19 individuals that were mildly ill. So those are the folks that maybe that stay at home and don't go to the hospital. And essentially, one study that needs to be done is, does vitamin D help prevent the worsening of symptoms or decrease the rates of hospitalization when we look at mildly ill? I think from my gut feeling, if you are vitamin D sufficient, then the answer would be no. If you're vitamin D deficient, that's certainly something that's open for interpretation. And as we know more about that, we will continue to follow up with it and let you know as well. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Dr. Derry and I have a daily show at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time, where we go into more detail on stories and answer your questions about COVID-19.
You can find Doc Griggs at DocGriggs1 on social media, and you can find me at Dr. Mark Allen Derry or at DRDERY. You can follow us at Noise Filter on Instagram, Noise Filter NOLA on Twitter, and for more information about us and the show, you can go to noisefiltershow.com. Hey, Doc Griggs, any last words?
Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving, and remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right. Thank you.
I'm Dr. Demento, and you are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor It Did Happen Here, the podcast producers, Thursday, March 11th from 6 to 8 p.m. This Zoom conversation is hosted